Rodney Ogwang was sick. Very, very sick.
I went down to the hospital to get checked, and even walking was difficult. So it starts with a fever. You feel a bit feverish. Then you start feeling joint pain. And then the headaches begin. Then I started puking. So then I finally got meds and went back home. And all I can remember is for comfort, laying on the floor for hours. I could barely eat. I mean, I live on my own at the time. And it was just an excruciating experience. I'm looking for the right words. Like, you're going to die.
Ogwang was suffering from malaria. He's 31 years old now and a malaria researcher. He was born and raised in Uganda, the nation with the third highest malaria burden in the world. As a teen, he went to boarding school in Kampala. So when he contracted malaria last year as an adult, it was not his first time.
I started getting malaria when I was in high school and literally would get it every term. I remember being picked up from school and I had to be carried out of the school clinic, and I was driven to a hospital in Kampala. And I remember I struggled to put my finger on the feeling, but I just remember largely that I was barely conscious. I could only remember opening my eyes every so often and seeing my parents and my auntie sitting on the side of the bed and slipping in and out of sleep. And I don't know if it's sleep or something else, but yeah, and feeling extremely cold, so covering up and yet sweating extensively.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Malaria is one of the oldest and most devastating diseases known to humankind. The malaria antigen has been detected in Egyptian remains approximately 5,000 years old. The disease has shaped human history, even human biology. It killed between 150 million to 300 million people in the 20th century alone. And today, 40% of the world's population lives in places where malaria is transmitted. But by far, it's the people of sub-Saharan Africa who suffer the disease's greatest impact.
I think for us, it's almost normal. If you haven't had malaria before, you are the odd one out.
Malaria is especially devastating to children. UNICEF estimates that every 2 minutes, a child under the age of 5 dies of malaria. In Uganda, the disease is still a top cause of infant and child illness and death. Malaria researcher Rodney Ogwang has seen why. When he suffered from malaria as a teen, Ogwang lived in the capital city of Kampala. He went to a private boarding school, and he had a family with the means to get him quickly to hospital. It saved his life. Children living elsewhere in Uganda are not so lucky.
It was around 2017, and it was in the height of an almost a malaria epidemic at that point. So I, working in the labs, every 10 or so children you test, 5 to 7 of them would be positive for malaria. These are school-going children, right? But they've had to walk from, I don't know what kind of distance, to get to the hospital to find some kind of treatment. And many of them, by the time they even arrive at the hospital, the malaria has progressed so much that a child is even getting comatose. And when your child is beginning to have now severe disease, now they're going to even have more problems because they're going to have cognitive problems. And some will suffer long-term seizures and maybe even develop epilepsy later in life. And such a child would definitely have had severe impact simply because they couldn't get medication fast enough.
Okay, you can now speak.
Yes, I'm not getting you.
But speak up.
Hi. Good evening.
Carol Wanisa is mother to 4 children. They live in Moroto Town, northeastern Uganda. Her three-month-old infant got malaria just 2 weeks after being born. Her almost three-year-old toddler has suffered from malaria consistently for his entire life. She can't count the number of times the child has had the disease, which means Juanisa and her babies are constantly in and out of the hospital, which is where she spoke to us over Zoom.
Almost every month we are in the hospital. Yeah, the baby was cryosome. He cried endlessly. Then he had the high fever. He had some cough. Okay, that very time, yes, I was scared because I could not believe a child of 2 weeks can suffer from malaria. Of course, as a mother, it is too scary, and you feel like you've got a child, and the child has to grow in a healthy manner, in a good condition. But now when the child falls sick and all the time you're in the hospital, you get scared. Malaria being a killer disease, all the time on drip, treatment, injections, swallowing tabs. Ah. We use a mosquito net. I make sure I put him in the net by 5. Why he sleeps and slides on the sides of the net, and then mosquitoes get that chance of biting him. Maybe that is the case. But he enters the net early enough. I make sure he enters early enough. How is it affecting their lives? Okay. Of course, when they fall sick, they tend to remain home. We retain them home. They don't attend school. That means they miss a lot from school when they are at home, being attended to treat them to get better. How it affects my life, eh? On the side of working class people and me as well. It affects because all the time we spend all our time or most of the times in the hospital with the children. And then we tend now to look after, to care for them, and we neglect now work. Even our bosses, they also get demoralized. Actually, I almost lost a job because of that. Even ourselves, health-wise, I'm not fine, I'm not comfortable. When the child falls sick, everything, you feel you're paralyzed, the whole body. You'll never be in peace. You cannot rest. And even the work you're doing is paralyzed. You cannot again concentrate. Not until that child recovers and you see that he's now normalized and he's doing well.
Carol Juanisa wants one simple thing: for her children to grow up normally, disease-free. Well, it's not often that we can say this, but there is good news on the horizon. After thousands of years of human suffering, hundreds of years of research, and decades of intense application of modern medicine, on October 6th, 2021, the World Health Organization made an historic announcement.
As some of you may know, I started my career as a malaria researcher, and I longed for the day that we would have an effective vaccine against this ancient and terrible disease. And today is that day.
Dr. Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus, WHO director, announcing the approval of the first ever malaria vaccine and the first ever vaccine for a parasitic disease. Dr. Mashidiso Moeti, WHO Africa regional director, says the vaccine could change lives across the continent.
Today's recommendation therefore offers a glimmer of hope for the continent. We expect many more African children will be protected from malaria and grow into healthy and productive adults.
Truthfully, that will take time. But today, we're going to talk about this remarkable good news. What did it take to develop a malaria vaccine? Is it effective enough? And what remains to be done before the scourge of malaria can truly end? Well, joining us today from Kampala in Uganda is Dr. James Tibenderana, and he's Global Technical Director at the Malaria Consortium. Welcome to On Point.
Thank you, Meghna. Good evening, good afternoon, good morning, all your listeners.
Hello to the world. Well, Dr. Dr. Tibenderana, will you first describe to me? We heard from two other Ugandans there just now, but broadly speaking, over time, what impact has malaria had on Uganda?
The impact of malaria in Uganda and on Uganda has been substantial. Uganda has different levels of malaria endemicity. And just to put it in context, a adult or a child who's living in parts of Uganda and does not use any preventive tools could experience anywhere between 4 to more than 1,500 infective bites per year. And so it's a disease over the years that has caused substantial deaths and substantial illness in the country. Mm. In 2019, we had something like 4,000 deaths or 13 million cases attributable to malaria. And that is because of the really efforts to introduce nets to reduce the impact. And before that, you could imagine the order of about, we had numbers about 300 deaths a day attributable to malaria. And I think we're fortunate that currently that number has drastically reduced and we have something like about 10 deaths a day attributable to malaria. I also want to put it in the economic context. In terms of Uganda as a country, malaria costs the country about $24 per person per annum. And that is in terms of lost income or the fact that the country has to invest resources to tackle malaria. And so Uganda itself has not achieved its full economic potential as it could have if we did not have malaria.
Well, Dr. James Tibenderana, stand by for just a moment because we're going to talk about when we come back about the vaccine and whether that can turn the tide on this massive effect that malaria has been having for hundreds of years on Uganda. We'll be back. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and today we are actually exploring a good news story. The WHO's approval earlier this month of the first ever vaccine for malaria and the first ever vaccine for a parasitic disease. We're going to talk about the complications around this particular vaccine in a few minutes, but let us just spend a little bit more time talking about what it might mean for countries, particularly in sub-Saharan Africa, like Uganda, where Dr. James Tibenderana joins us from Kampala. He's global director, a global technical director at the Malaria Consortium. And Dr. Tibenderana, you were talking to me about the fact that malaria has been a yoke around Uganda's sort of collective shoulders, preventing the country from reaching its full economic potential. Malaria is still a top cause of illness and death in Uganda. It is treatable. It's a treatable disease. And yet there are many obstacles for Ugandans to get some of those treatments in time. So all of that combined, what was your reaction when the news of the WHO's approval of this new vaccine was released to the world?
Meghna, I was really excited. I was relieved that finally, after all that research, development, that finally a positive recommendation for the first malaria vaccine was achieved. I was also, I must say, a bit disappointed. Why so? Because it's taken us more than 30 years to get to this point. And yet, in those years, the number of children, adults that have suffered the devastating effects of malaria have been substantial. And what my hope is that going forward, the research and development, as well as the research and introduction of the future vaccines, will take a shorter period of time.
Right. So
I was also not under the illusion that that would be just, you know, the magic, the silver bullet, because we do have challenges ahead. And I think those are the sorts of things that the positive recommendation allows us to start dealing with.
I'm so glad that you said all of that, because those complications and the challenges we must discuss, and we will in a few minutes, because there is no silver bullet for a disease like this that has been with humanity for so long and caused so much death and suffering. But just for a moment, I should have asked this earlier, but Dr. Tibendarana, have you had malaria before?
Oh, Meghna, there are very few Africans that haven't had malaria my age. So, yes, I have had malaria. And in 1973, malaria almost killed me. It was the first episode of malaria that I had. And I was really lucky that my parents had a high sense of awareness that it could be malaria. And their prompt action in taking me to the hospital saved my life. And I think from that point onwards, I have really paid extra attention to the disease, because I could have been one of those statistics that could have died from the disease.
Mm. You know, it is still so unacceptable is the best word I can come up with to hear you state the fact, and it is a fact, that most Africans have had malaria. We are talking about an entire continent of human beings. And that's why this is so important. So let me ask you, again, we will discuss some of the challenges that remain, and they are many, with eradicating malaria. But what difference might this first step, this vaccine, make if it becomes widely available in Uganda? What difference might it make for Uganda?
It will make an important difference, Meghna. I think the first thing to realize is that it's a preventive tool. And earlier you said that malaria is treatable, but I want to highlight that malaria is preventable. Mm. And I think it is for those who may fall sick and then require treatment. But I think we just have to keep it in mind that this is a preventable disease. And for those who then fall sick, there are opportunities for good treatment. And then there's a proportion, a variety of factors. Sometimes factors, as you saw with the case of Rodney, where distances come to play, or there may be a situation where they get a very severe form of malaria called severe malaria that really has a very high mortality rate. So I think it's a mindset that we have an additional tool that can prevent malaria. Mm-hmm. And with all the bad news and the devastation that COVID-19 has had, with the news that malaria has been stalling, I think it's a positive message that really will help, one, governments to recommit themselves to the fight against malaria, but also for the population to really embrace the idea that these new tools exist and will be coming on board, and that malaria elimination is something that they should embrace.
But you all, I'm just going to jump in here, Doctor, if I could, and forgive me, because you also raise an important point, though, and that is, why did it take so long to even get to this step? And so if you just stand by for a moment, Dr. Tibendarana, I want to turn now, if I can, to Dr. Ripley Ballou. He's with us from Washington, and he began his work on vaccines at Walter Reed Army Institute of Research many decades ago, where he led the team with GSK that eventually co-developed this new malaria vaccine. Dr. Ballou, welcome to you.
Hi, Meghna. Thanks for having me.
So first of all, I will say congratulations, because this is a major step forward in the global battle against malaria. But can you take me back to the beginning? How long have you been at work on this vaccine?
Well, Meghna, the recommendation came on October 6th, and just 2 days before, I celebrated my 70th birthday. So going back 35, 36 years when I started working on this, I had just finished my training in business and was a young researcher at the Walter Reed Army Institute of Research. And one of my first assignments to work on a malaria vaccine. And so, you know, it goes back a long ways.
You sent us a picture of you as a younger man with your arm out and a cup over your arm and with a big smile on your face. Can you tell us what you were doing in that picture in those early days of trying to develop this vaccine?
So what you're seeing in that picture is my my arm is on top of a five mosquitoes in it and a little bit of a net on top of it. And the mosquitoes are biting my arm. This is how the first version of the malaria vaccine that we worked on. And this was something that at that time at Walter Reed was a kind of a tradition where scientists who developed vaccines on themselves first. So myself and some of my colleagues participate in this clinical trial where we took the vaccine and had it, and then about a month later allowed us to be exposed to the bite these infected mosquitoes that had been raised in the laboratory. We knew that they had chloroquine-sensitive malaria, parasites, and this was how we tested the vaccine to see whether it would work.
I'm going to presume you got malaria then because the early vaccines weren't effective.
Correct. And I'll tell you, Rodney described it perfectly. I couldn't anything to what he said. I have never been so sick in my life. I thought I was going to die. And I had access to very good treatment, but I needed there was a little bit in making the diagnosis because they had to actually see parasites in my blood per the protocol. And almost 36 hours before we actually saw any parasites. And I experienced the full-blown syndrome, and it left a huge impression on me.
Wow. So you gave yourself malaria to test early versions of this vaccine 30-some years ago. There are two important questions, and I keep coming back to what Dr. Tibendarana was telling us about how long this has taken. So briefly, Dr. Ballou, if you could, scientifically, what was so challenging about developing this vaccine?
Out of that first study in the mid-80s, we actually had one volunteer that was protected, and that person's strongest immune response of all the people that had been vaccinated. So we had evidence that if you can get the right immune response, here primarily about a measurement of antibodies, and there's an interesting similarity to everything everybody about COVID vaccines. If you need that right kind of immune response, and it needs to persist for a certain length of time. It took us a decade to get to a formulation, a version of the vaccine that was potent, and which when we did exactly the same kind of challenge study with those volunteers, we had seven of the volunteers protected. And that was really an aha moment that the light bulb goes off. We say, okay, we're this vaccine. That's 1997. Hmm. So a decade just to get to that point.
Okay. So just to get to that point, and then you had to get further. And also, I mean, there's a whole, I suppose, an area of science that we just don't have time to talk about regarding the fact that this is a parasitic disease and not a viral or bacterial one, which makes it complicated for a whole different set of reasons. But Dr. Tibendarana, I want to turn back to you and just ask something straight out. Do you also think, is it possible that there were economic and political reasons why perhaps, you know, developers like Dr. Ballou maybe didn't get the funding or the resources to accelerate the development of the malaria vaccine? I guess what I'm asking is, when the primary people who are suffering the burden of a disease live in sub-Saharan Africa, does the rest of the world not put as much effort in as it could?
I can only give a speculative answer, Meghna, but I think what COVID-19 has demonstrated is that with the threat evident globally, the minds, the technology, the funding can be made available to surmount a challenge. And I think, as has been said, this is a parasitic disease. But I really, again, want to frame this in context. 1,400 deaths occur per day globally as a result of malaria. 600 cases occur daily as a result of malaria. That is a disease that requires a concerted effort globally. And this is after we have distributed nets. So I think to give a very concise answer, I will only speculate and say that the burden, unfortunately, falls on Africa, on low middle income countries that do not themselves have the economic capacity to put more resources into research and development. Mm. But given the challenges, I do think that if there was a concerted effort, and this is my personal opinion, there was a concerted effort, this is a challenge that we can rise up to. Mm. Because looking forward, the solution for malaria elimination or malaria eradication is going to be a vaccine. It may not be RTSS. There are other vaccines in development. And the effort that is required to get better vaccines with longer effect really needs to be a priority.
Right. So Dr. Tibindarana and Dr. Baloo, stand by, because there are so many complications to the remarkable story of this new vaccine that both of you know very well. There's yet another twist. You were talking about formulating that immune response. Well, one of the vaccine's most critical ingredients comes from the bark of a tree that's found in one place, in Chile. The rare evergreen has long been used by indigenous Mapuche people to make soap and medicine, but it also has a special bark. Now, this tree is called the Kiai tree, and the bark of the Kiai contains compounds that stimulate human immune response. Well, Ricardo San Martin is one of the world's leading experts on the Kiai.
These trees are one of the major natural resources down there in Chile against the climate change. Because they grow in areas which are dry. And because of this history of over 120, 30 years of exploitation, it's reaching a point where you have to be very careful to how many trees you exploit that are in the wilderness.
San Martin himself has a complex connection to the tree. About 30 years ago, he is the person who discovered how to extract compounds from Kiai bark that now go into vaccines for malaria, for shingles, and even one of the COVID vaccines. Well, now San Martin says the industry he helped build is threatening the tree itself.
I think it's already reaching the critical level of exploitation. When I say erased against time, my horizon is 2 to 3 years.
2 to 3 years until harvesting bark from the Kiai becomes unsustainable.
Right now, you're a company that needs these compounds for the vaccines. You have to take them from the bark of old trees. You take the bark, you extract the bark, and you get those compounds. And those are the ones that go into the malaria vaccine. Alternatively, you can say, okay, I don't need to wait 30 to 40 years. I need to understand what the plant, how these compounds are produced in the plants, how to stimulate the production of these compounds by temperature, by light, by the kind of soil you put it in, and then get it from just the biomass of one-year-old plants. And if that's the case, then you don't have to fell the old trees. You just have to plant thousands of little trees. But at the end, it's worthwhile to have thousands of little trees than just one single old tree.
So San Martin is currently at work developing methods to extract the Kiai's unique compounds from young, one-year-old trees versus having to wait 30 or 40 years for the rarer, older trees to mature. It's a faster way to ensure the sustainability of these critical trees and to ensure the availability of vaccines. Because synthetic replacements, if they are developed, would reset the regulatory clock, setting back vaccine availability by a decade or more. For San Martin, it's a matter of public health urgency and personal redemption.
Because I'm native from Chile, and I developed this whole industry in the country. So I'm responsible for what's going on down there now. And I felt very good with myself and my kids and everyone when I developed this sustainable process, pruning the trees and saving thousands of trees from being felled. But now we are back to a point where, you know, the exploitation has increased. And I have a 10-year-old. I want her to be proud of my work too, saying, you know, I started this, but now it needs a 2.0 version of the story where you don't need even to fell trees. You just grow small plants.
Ricardo San Martin is a scientist at the University of California, Berkeley, and a consultant for Desert King International, which extracts Kei tree compounds for vaccine manufacturers. And again, the Kei tree found only in Chile, and yet another critical part of this amazing story of a new malaria vaccine. More when we come back. This is On Point.
I'm Kathleen Goldhar, and I'm the host of a new podcast, Crime Story. Every week, we bring you a different crime, told by the storyteller who knows it best.
You got one witness who can't be found. You got another witness who's murdered.
We couldn't sugarcoat this story.
I was getting calls from Cosby's attorney threatening to sue every day.
Every crime in one way or another is a reflection of who we are as a people, as a city, as a country.
Find us wherever you get your podcasts.
Smart journalism, fascinating topics, words that describe CNN's podcast, The Assignment with Audie Cornish.
Last year, the Army missed its recruitment goal. It had 65,000 spots to fill and came up 10,000 short of that target. Why is it so hard to recruit? How's the Pentagon responding? And how are the voices of service members on social media shifting the balance?
Listen to The Assignment with Audie Cornish wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and today we're taking some time to talk about the remarkable and much welcome good news story about the approval by the WHO this month of the first ever malaria vaccine. And we're also talking about the long road yet to travel to eradicate malaria off the face of the earth and what that particularly means for the nations of sub-Saharan Africa that bear the greatest burden of malaria. I'm joined today by Dr. James Tibenderana. He's with us from Kampala in Uganda. He's the Global Technical Director at the Malaria Consortium. And Dr. Ripley Ballou also joins us from Washington. He began his work on vaccines at the Walter Reed Army Institute of Research decades ago and is a member of the team that developed this new malaria vaccine. Again, he's been at work on it for more than 30 years. And doctors, if you could just stand by for another minute or two and listen along with me, because I just think we cannot emphasize enough how long and devastating this disease has, how long it's been with us and how devastating it's been to humanity. Because at the top of the show, you heard me describe how researchers had discovered the malaria antigen in the remains of found in Egypt that date back some 5,000 years. Well, in fact, the disease has been with humankind for much, much longer than that.
We've had malaria since the very beginning of our evolution. We carried it with us when we walked out of Africa and settled the continents, and wherever mosquito transmission was possible, malaria took hold. We had malaria across ancient Greece, ancient Rome. That's how we got the name malaria, from mal, aria, for bad air. The Romans built temples to the fever goddesses. It shaped how they did their architecture. They built their villas high up in the hills with courtyards and windows facing inside rather than outside, so they wouldn't be exposed to the bad air of malaria.
That's Sonia Shaw. She's author of The Fever, How Malaria Has Ruled Humankind for 500,000 Years. Now, the Vedic Indians back in 1500 BC called malaria the king of diseases. It's mentioned in Homer's The Iliad. And speaking of the Romans, well, Roman soldiers may have spread malaria throughout Europe, and historians theorize the disease may have contributed to the fall of Rome. Well, more recently, circa the late 19th century, Shaw says malaria determined the fate of the Panama Canal.
So building a canal through Panama was a dream for many, many years, of course, because it would save so much time, you know, of shipping. Otherwise, people had to go all the way around the tip of South America. So the French tried it at first, and they failed miserably. Tens of thousands of workers died of yellow fever and malaria because there's so much mosquito-borne disease in this part of the world. Finally, the U.S. took over and ended up spending hundreds of thousands of dollars and commanding the entire U.S. supply of things like sulfur, perithrium, and kerosene oil to wipe out all the mosquitoes in this one little area so they could build a canal finally.
The disease is also intertwined with the dark history of colonialism, both in Africa and in the Americas.
It was considered like a thing you had to go through when you came to America. They called it the seasoning. So when Europeans would come over and they'd bring, you know, their family members would come later and they would say, well, now that you're seasoned to this place, which meant you had suffered through malaria and survived. So you would get some degree of immunity.
Even in the slave trade, immunity from malaria had a literal price, a cash value.
The people who came over, the enslaved Africans who came over, had some immunity to the worst kinds of malaria. And that was also considered in, you know, the price of slaves and things like that. So malaria really shaped the economy of slavery in the United States. And it persisted after the Civil War. You know, people carried malaria out west. And it was really thought that we would never get rid of malaria and we would never be able to settle the West because there was too much malaria and people didn't know what to do about it.
Ultimately, malaria was eradicated in the United States, but Sonia Shaw notes that was more by coincidence than by design.
We got rid of it because we invested in roads and in better housing, and basically we paved over about half of our wetlands, which is where all the malaria and mosquitoes lived. So we kind of did it by accident, almost as a product of development. And it was the same story in much of Europe. That's how malaria receded from those places in right up until the mid-20th century. So as much as we want, you know, the silver bullet that will solve malaria everywhere else, in fact, the only thing that has actually worked against malaria is development, is increasing prosperity.
Sonia Shaw, she's the author of The Fever, How Malaria Has Ruled Humankind for 500,000 years. Dr. Ballou, let me turn back to you here, because there is a question embedded in what Sonia said that I had previously asked Dr. Tibendarana, and I wanted to get your response. I mean, theorize with me for a moment, if you would. If malaria had remained endemic in, say, the United States, do you think a vaccine might have come faster?
I mean, obviously, if there is a disease that is in a developed nation, there is going to be resources put against it. We saw this with COVID. I think that fundamentally, though, there's a difference between the eradication of malaria in the United States or the United States versus what is possible on the sub-Saharan continent. And that's primarily the mosquitoes that are present in sub-Saharan Africa, and particularly an Anopheles disease, a complex that's called Anopheles gambiae, is extremely efficient at transmitting this disease in their wetlands. They can live in a small divot in the ground where a cow has walked by, a little bit of water the last time it rained for it to develop. And this is a very different set of mosquitoes than what were indigenous to the United States, which were much less capable of transmitting it. So the pressure on the force of infection in Africa is orders of magnitude greater than experience in the United States. But your point is correct. When we worked on this malaria vaccine many years, it was very difficult to get funding to help support it. The company, GSK, put a lot of the Bill and Melinda Gates were partners for most of the 20 years actually developed this. The biggest obstruction, and I don't mean to say, but the biggest challenge we had around moving this vaccine forward was that we demonstrate impact on morbidity and mortality, because that's what everybody's worried about. They're dying. How can you show that the vaccine actually will have that impact? Because the international community needs to put resources to purchase and deliver vaccine programs. And so this high hill that you have to climb can you prevent infection, which is what our clinical trial program was able to demonstrate. Importantly, could you then go on and show that you would have an impact when the vaccine is actually used? What has been happening over the last 5 or 6 years since completion of our phase three program that demonstrated that, yes, this vaccine actually will prevent malaria. And I think what the big message, and I think this was the turning point for the show, was the demonstration that if you use this vaccine along with all of the other programs like the bed net programs, the insecticide treated bed nets, mm-hmm. And you had seasonal chemoprophylaxis where they give in areas where you have really intense seasonal transmission, give the vaccine at the beginning of the season, and you periodically season give some drugs, we were able to show a reduction in mortality by 70%.
Okay.
Data that really changes people's mind and say, okay, we're going to put resources behind that.
So Dr. Tibendrana, let me turn to you on that, because what Dr. Balu just described was a multifaceted campaign, essentially, and the vaccine being a part of it, and, you know, treated nets, also prophylactic treatment, et cetera. But the vaccine itself, those things together provided that 70% effectiveness, as Dr. Balu said. But the vaccine itself, I understand, is 30 in isolation is roughly 30% effective. So what challenges does that pose? Because I imagine that the Global Vaccine Alliance, I believe it's called Gavi, might be taking a look at whether or not it's worth the investment to really push vaccine out to a lot of places with its isolated low efficacy. Can you help us understand what that means, Dr. Tibendrana?
I think, as you've sort of described, is that this is the starting point. I think let's keep the perspective. This is a 30-plus-year-old vaccine, and technology has sort of moved on. So the anticipation is that the next generation of vaccines will probably have more protective effect. But I think the point here for me is that even when we look back at things like nets, at some of the other tools that we've deployed, we've tended to start off with fairly reasonable effect sizes. And over time, we've learned how to use them in combination, like Ripley was saying, by combining RTSS with seasonal use of treatments. You can increase the effect to reducing about 70% of deaths. So I think individually, some of these tools are not perfect, but by having the tools available and by having a positive recommendation from WHO, it then opens the door for implementers and national programs to really adapt and identify their best use. So back to the point about Gavi, I think we are certainly in a bit of a dilemma because we have a cost-effective but slightly more expensive tool. And yet we know that the funding that's necessary for us to deploy our existing tools is far lower than we require. So I think what we have to be looking at is new financing, is not to sort of compromise our existing tools or identify funding that, you know, currently exists. I think for this, we need to be working with Gavi and other, you know, financing instruments to really identify new funding that can come for the procurement of the vaccine, but also the delivery of the vaccine through either immunization programs or, as Ripley was saying, seasonal malaria chemoprevention programs. Mm.
So, Dr. Tibendrana, you just said something that was so important. I want to underscore it. You said that even now, vaccine aside, there is inadequate funding for the preventative, for already known preventative measures for malaria. Is that right? Did I hear you correctly?
Yes, yes. WHO estimates that to deliver the global technical strategy, we need about 6.8 to 7 billion US dollars per annum. And at present, we're only operating with about 3 billion US dollars per annum.
So less than half of what's needed. And now the vaccine is coming in as another powerful tool in this toolkit, but at some additional cost. So, I mean, is it not time for the international community, Dr. Tibenderana, to step up here? Because these tools in combination, as Dr. Balu said, 70% effectiveness in pushing back this terrible disease. So what's stopping the international community? What do you think?
I think we need political commitment across all levels of governance. I think it's important that national governments in Africa, who in Abuja declared 15% contribution to the health sector, also step up and meet their obligations. And then they have the moral authority to really stand up and challenge, the international community to really look at the long goal of malaria elimination. I think we can no longer keep talking about controlling malaria. We really have to globally commit and say what is the investments that's required, especially for new tools. And not just look at malaria as a health. I think what some of your speakers have shown is that malaria is an economic problem. Mm. Countries on average that are endemic for malaria grow 1.3% of GDP per capita slower than countries that don't have malaria. So this is an issue that needs to be discussed at the World Bank, at the IMF, Africa Development Bank, not just Gavi, Global Fund, President's Malaria Initiative. This is an economic issue. And therefore, we need to be looking at it from the health side and the economic side.
Point so well taken. And if there's any moment in which the entire global community can no longer deny that diseases have an economic impact, it's now, with, even the most developed countries suffering the economic impacts from COVID, right? I mean, I think the scales must have fallen from our collective eyes worldwide. So let me just close. We've got less than a minute left. Dr. Balu, let me turn back to you again. You've been dedicating your professional life to this. So a major step forward with the malaria vaccine and the WHO's approval. But in the 30 seconds that we have, do we dare hope for sometime in the future a world where malaria is eradicated?
That's been the vision of the malaria vaccine treatment community for most of the last two decades. I think that the approval is a huge step forward, and it really should allow us and commit us to double down and achieve this goal that we've all community has set out.
Well, Dr. Ripley Balu is Advanced Program Lead and Principal Investigator at IAVI. He's been working for more than 30 years on a vaccine for malaria, which the WHO approved just this month. Dr. Balu, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Megan.
And Dr. James Tibenderana, joining us from Kampala in Uganda, Global Technical Director at the Malaria Consortium. Dr. Tibenderana, thank you so very much.
Thank you, Meghna.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.